and try to answer, or at least raise the question, how much incarnation can your Christ withstand? And towards the end of the hour, we'll try to, what I may try to, in, to substitute a word that may be new to me, new to some of you, how much docetism can your Christ withstand? Docetism is another term that we will get into. So, does anybody need the word Christology defined or redefined? It's the study of Jesus Christ. The word incarnation, that may be an obvious word, but let's go ahead and define it anyway. Incarnation is in karos, in flesh, becoming human. So we can talk about ideas becoming incarnate, we can talk about God becoming incarnate, and things like that. The doctrine of the incarnation of Christ, the locus classicus for it, is John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the light was the light of all. The Word, skipping down to verse 14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth, and we have beheld His glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father. So, here is the idea of the incarnation. And this is very specific. John speaks in very declarative sentences, using the verb to be. The Word was God. The Word became flesh. So this is a doctrine here of the incarnation. My overriding idea today is that we as the Christian Church have not always understood the idea of the incarnation of Christ into Jesus. We understand a lot about Christ, which is not Jesus' last name, by the way, but is His title. And we understand a lot about Christ, His mission, His salvation, His atonement, theology of the cross, these kind of things. But I'm going to try to take an attack that we don't understand so much about Jesus as we understand about Christ. And this is to our peril. And I would appreciate your raising your hand at any time, asking questions, making challenges of anything that I might say. There are a lot of Christologies that one can find in theology. There are Christologies that emphasize the historical nature of Jesus. There are spirit Christologies. There are Christologies that come from above. There are Christologies that come from below. The one from above would be more of a Christ-centered. The one from below might be more of a Jesus-centered or a humanity-centered. There are Christologies that are called cosmic Christologies. Matthew Fox has a book in our library about the cosmic Christ. He's trying to get reconnected with an earlier tradition that has been forgotten for a few hundred years. Jesus Himself spoke of many titles, Son of Man, Son of David. What are some other titles that are used by Jesus? Each of these titles, though, would imply a different kind of Christology. Each is sort of like a facet on a single diamond, or a prism, the many colors of white light entering through a prism. And like I was saying before the tape started rolling, is that each Christology is going to implicate the culture from which it arises. We look through, if we're going to look at Christology or Jesus Christ, pretty much we're going to be looking into a mirror. We're going to be trying to see how Jesus might look to us through the context of our own times, our own concerns, our own needs. Who we study Christology with, who we don't study Christology with, who does it leave out, who does it include. These are all contextual issues related to the study of Jesus Christ. Now, the view that of Christ that I want to hold up is a view of Jesus, that we cannot have a Christology without an incarnation. Now, that sounds obvious. Christ, the Messiah, became enfleshed. To deny otherwise is to engage in the oldest heresy of the church called Docetism. It might be helpful to put up a continuum of sorts. This is incarnation. We have a continuum to Docetism. The more incarnate one's Christ might be, the less one can be susceptible to the charge of Docetism. What does Docetism mean? Without flesh. It is a Greek term that essentially denies the humanity of Jesus Christ, or it denies the humanity of any idea you may want to have. Docetism. It's the oldest heresy of the Christian church, and the one that pops up the most still. So, the word incarnation, I think the idea of the word incarnation comes from a very Jewish concept. And I'm going to write it in Hebrew just to show off a little bit. See if I can... Yeah. Yada, which means to know by experience. It is not the same word in Greek, to know, because in Greek, the verb to know means to know intellectually. In Hebrew thought, to know means to know experientially. And this is when we read in the First Testament, the Jewish scriptures, somebody knew somebody. And that is in a sexual, sensuous sense. So it is to know by experience. And sexual knowledge is one way of knowing, especially among the Hebrews. We've gotten away from that a little bit, and I think again to our peril. But the word incarnation as an idea, I believe, is based in this verb of Hebrew, to know. Now, I've been going pretty fast. Are there any comments or questions so far? I'm a little out of breath, so I must be talking too fast. Now, as we just heard, the Gospel of John uses the words to be, the verbs to be, in that language to say what happened. Jesus is God. It's not Jesus appears to be God or Jesus might be God. It's Jesus is God. The incarnation did happen. It is an is. It is not an ought. It is not something that could be. It is an is, an actuality. But the early church did not agree for about 450 years as to how Jesus is God, and how Jesus is incarnate, and how Jesus of Nazareth is God. Christ died in about the year 30 in the common area called, I'm going to use CE instead of AD because of our Jewish friends, and I'm going to use BCE, before common era, instead of B.C., also because of our Jewish friends, and we'll hear more about that tomorrow. So the early church did not always agree. The problems began almost immediately because the faith moved around. The faith was contextualized here, and it was contextualized there, and it was contextualized in first century as well as every other century since. And each century, each context, is going to be asking different questions. Let's imagine ourselves to be in the year 35, Common Era. Jesus died about 5 years ago. Suppose that you all became Christians. Half of you, after you became Christians in the Jerusalem area, left for Syria. The other half of you went across the Mediterranean, or maybe went around to Egypt, to Africa. When each of you got to your new cities, you made new friends. You told them about this new person called Jesus, this new way of life, this new way of thinking, new way of being faithful. And soon, because of your influence, local churches sprang up. Well, problems immediately began because many of you were formerly Jewish. What should we do about Jewish law? What should we do in our worship? What do we do with our Jewish scriptures? How much of the old do we discard? How much of the new do we embrace? Keep in mind, there's no Second Testament yet, no Christian scriptures. They don't even get written for another generation or two, and they don't get set for another 200 years or so. Suppose, though, now the year 75 CE, suppose 40 years later in the year 75, you, Christians in Syria, travel to the Egyptian church. Jerusalem has been destroyed 5 years ago, and you want to see how other Christians are doing the faith. So the Syrian Christians go to the Egyptian Christians, and they start worshiping together, but to your surprise, you find so little in common. There's so little in common apart from a basic, general allegiance to this Jesus called Christ. Fragments of his words have been handed down orally, but the context of these fragments vary from place to place. You'll use the worship patterns differently. You'll use the Jewish scriptures differently. They're all different. Now, the question comes, which of the two groups most faithfully represents the gospel of Jesus Christ? Or which most faithfully represents Jesus? This is just a little exercise to show how difficult it is to understand these kinds of issues. Now, it's 2 centuries later, and you're all still alive. And there are now not just 2 centers, maybe, but many centers of Christian faith, of Christian doctrine formulation. Because of the kaleidoscopic effects of these various communities, each has its own special context, its own special demands, its own special questions. The situation we saw in Syria and Egypt is now multiplied not to any beneficial effect in terms of coherence and organizing, but in terms of fragmentation. Kaleidoscopic, centrifugal forces are at work here. And now these Christians, because they're becoming a world, as it was to that time, a world power, they need to start unifying their views. So they start asking questions about the nature of God, the nature of the Holy Spirit, the nature of Jesus. And starting in around the year 250, and for another 200 years, they, Christians, met, mostly men, on 8 different occasions in Ephesus, in Nicaea, and in Constantinople. And they were asking the question, primarily they were asking the question of the nature of God, but one of the big sub-issues was, what's the nature of Jesus Christ? Is Jesus human? Is Jesus divine? Is it a mixture? Is it 50-50? 75-25? 100-100? You know, these are very, very much the kind of issues that are going on. The context of all of these basically is in Greek thought. So Greek terms, Greek philosophy is being used, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. Central to all this hammering out process is the nature of Jesus' identity. How do we think about Jesus? What is his origin? Is he human? If so, how much? Is he divine? How? It's a very complex question. Many books have been written. Many forests have been felled to supply the pages of books written about this process. And I'm not about to pretend to understand it all or to relate it to you. But I just want to pass over some basic things here. At first, the councils decided that Jesus is consubstantial with God. Con, this is one word, I'm just reminding you. Consubstantial, substance, you can probably understand there. Con meaning with, of equal substance. The same substance with God. Okay? But that left the question of how is Jesus related to the flesh that he obviously inhabited. It took another 200 years, and again you're all alive and you're all witnessing this. In Jesus the Christ, they decided in the year 451 in a famous council at Chalcedon, however you want to pronounce it, Christ is united into two natures, a divine and a human, without confusion, without change, without division or separation. But to get here, to this point in 451, during the past 200 years, various people, usually men again, proposed different formulae. Some they thought had too much divinity. Some they thought had too much humanity. And they had to arrive at a balancing. This is a tightrope act, if I ever saw one, of trying to define how much humanity, divinity, Jesus was experiencing, expressing, living out, and what are the implications of this for theology? So I want to remind you again that it was a very Greek question that was being asked. How could Jesus both be a God and a man at the same time? Now, the same question in other cultures may not even be thought of, but because it happened in a Greek context, this is how the question got framed. I want to read you the phrases that the Council of Chalcedon arrived at in order to define Jesus. It is very succinct, and listen for the words in translation, truly God and truly human. Following then the Holy Fathers, we all with one voice teach that it should be confessed that our Lord Jesus Christ is one and the same Son, the same perfect in Godhead, the same perfect in manhood, truly God and truly man, the same consisting of a rational soul and body, homoousios, or the Greek for of the same substance with the Father as to the Godhead, and the same homoousios with us as in his manhood, in all things like unto us, sin only excepted, begotten of the Father before ages as to his Godhead, and in the last days the same for us in our salvation, of Mary the Virgin, Theotokos, or Mother of God, as to his manhood. Now that's one sentence, but that expresses it probably as succinctly as they could at the time to say that Jesus was truly God and truly human. Not a 50-50, 100-100, the way I understand that. I'll pause here if there's any comments or questions.
Why was it such a burning question for them, for the Greeks? Because it wasn't too much for the Latins, right?
You probably asked me a question I would have to stumble on in order to get. I'm not so sure why it was such a big problem for the Greeks. There were differences in Eastern theology and Western theology, and they had their own special emphases. But again, I'm going to confess ignorance as to the exact political forces demanding this question.
Were the Greeks trying to tie in the Christian idea of God to the Greek idea of God, which exists before Christianity comes on the scene, where God is without any emotions, without passions?
That's my understanding, and that's very well said. I hope you heard that. Yes?
It might be helpful if people understand that It's not just, when you say Greece, you just don't mean people that live where Greece is now.
Correct.
It's really the whole thought world, the whole Mediterranean.
Yeah, this is philosophy going on here, and Greek language was the only, or the Greek forms were the only language possible.
When Rome conquered Greece, they were really conquered by Greek art and religion and philosophy.
Yeah, okay.
Then it's helpful to remember that English is about 30% cognitive Greek, mm-hmm. and so we are Greek in that sense of philosophical terminology and the things we want to argue with.
Keep a mental finger there, please, and remind me of it when the time comes, because that's going to be something I'm going to come back to.
Was there also, in terms of the issue, why to the Greeks, is there some sense of an effort to deal with Gnosticism and mm-hmm. how that...
This
how
is that definitely an anti-Gnostic.
...fit in tradition in the region as to how does one understand the intersection of the divine and the human. And Gnosticism certainly worked, you know, for Indians to do that, but as to the historical period that was from.
Gnosticism takes the docetic view. Gnostics were a group of Christians living in the desert in the common area, a common era. Correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not a church historian very much. But when it came to Christ, their view of Christ was largely a docetic one. Now, I'm not so much interested in you getting the history here, but I do want you to see the basic trends that are going on and to see how much emphasis there was to define Jesus as Christ, to define how much incarnation there is in the Christ. Now I'd like for you to pretend that you're still alive and that all of you have witnessed the great expanse of Christian history. And what you have seen, I'm going to maintain, is a Christology that we come to that has forgotten certain key elements of the truly human aspects of Jesus. I began my study of Christology when I was in, I think just like you, in the church's nursery. The first song I remember knowing is, "Jesus Loves Little Children." And another song that I knew that's also very Christological is, "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Little ones to him belong. We are weak, he is strong." I grew up in the church. I learned a lot about Jesus. When I was 9 years old in a Southern Baptist church in Cary, North Carolina, I did what the ritual at the time, I walked the aisle. And became a Christian, and there was the pastor, who also happened to be my father, down there to receive me, and here I was, giving my life to Jesus. My pedigree in Christology continued, though. I went to Bible school religiously. I attended religious colleges, or a college that was religious. I worked at a Baptist conference center as staff for 2 summers. I was a 2-year volunteer in mission for the Southern Baptist to the country of South Korea. And I have attended not one, but 2 seminaries. I hope it will not reflect badly on either one after getting through that. But having done all this, learned all this, ingested all this, the study of Jesus, I like to make 2 confessions. And they'll seem paradoxical, but maybe if we think about them, they're not. I love Jesus, and Jesus loves me. The Bible tells me so. The second one is that I am very critical, not necessarily in a negative sense, but in probably a Greek sense, of how Jesus is presented to me in most churches that I have been in and know of today. Jesus is heavy on the Christ and too light on the Jesus. Why? What do churches do with the incarnation? We save it for Christmas pageants. We save it for church school with the little ones. We sing great but not necessarily sophisticated hymns about little baby Jesus. And then this is, and then our study of the incarnation is pretty much over, and unless you purposefully attend a seminar or something in your at your church sponsors. But generally, I think, maybe you can correct me, but the study of Jesusology is neglected to the study of Christology. The humanity is often neglected to the great and glorious wonder of the Christology. And I don't say that facetiously, because remember I say I love Jesus, but I don't love what's happened to Jesus in the church. Remember the pictures when you were growing up in your church? If they were like mine, Jesus was white. Isn't that right? And all the people around him were pretty well white. Jesus was presented as meek and mild. And I remember being questioned when I wanted to bring in Jesus overturning the tables in the temple. They said, well, Jesus was nonviolent. Jesus was meek and mild. But I still wanted to bring that out. Remember, Jesus was born from a virgin named Mary. Well, think about it. At least in our terms, Mary was an unmarried teenager mother. And he was his first little home was a manger. Doesn't that mean he was at first homeless? I mean, I'm not trying to be sensational here, but I'm just trying to put some new terminology, some new ideas about Jesus here. The incarnation, I will maintain, was probably more messy, more socially disreputable than we would want to allow it. Walter Wangren, who's going to be here later on this summer, I understand, has written a good poem, and I'd like to read parts of it, about how messy the incarnation can be. And this is from a poem. When Gabriel departed in all glory, and water was boiling, and I remember the coals I had blown before the angel stood before me. When I knelt down with tongs to spread those coals, my left hand on my thigh, my right hand reaching, scarcely recalling bright news for clay bowls. When someone called my name in the street, each thing common in my lot, equable as sand, then, just then I felt it a stitching in my right side, low, down, and deep. Stand up, Mary, I thought, but I could not move. This ache in my pelvis, this light larval spasm, I, who had never known motion in the caves of my womanhood, cried, the egg drops, oh my love. There came a moment when, resting on her pallet, Mary sat upright as though remembering, as though she'd murmur, I know it now. But she held her peace, did Mary. A smile like blotted water darkened her mouth. Like a new rain freshet spilled on the ledges below, her eyes said, I know. She tipped her head to the side as though attending to a word at her vulva. Does melting make a sound? Her hair ran all on her left breast down. I know. Then she touched the man beside her lightly to leave this moment undisturbed and whispered like a spray of roses, Joseph, my water broke. Mary delivered Jesus on her knees, pushed him head downward to the scalloped earth, bared between her knees, pressed for all her worth with both hands folded on her belly, squeezed her lids and lips, her teeth, her being, please, to dry him down, to bring him to his birth. Mary begged on her knees, God, God, Father, this hard hurt, please let your baby come. And this is how God resolved her maidenhood. She tore. In a rush, the flesh burst like a breached door. Blood poured before and with and on the infant. Blood, his first milk, air, his swaddling, and all his mother's good. Now, teach that in Sunday school and see where it gets you. That's an imaginative account of incarnation, but what I'm appealing for is imagination now. I think if we had a responsible version of the incarnation, we might want to rethink our commitment to the one incarnated. Jesus, as an incarnate God, was a victim. He was executed by capital punishment. He was poor. He wasn't white. He was a Palestinian. He was perhaps a radical zealot. This is rough stuff. If Jesus were alive today, he might all... And once thinking about Christ, if one denies Christ, the Jesus that is due him, one will get less Christ. Let me say that again. And one's thinking about Christ, if one denies the Christ, the Jesus that is due him, one will get less Christ. I want the incarnation to have its full say and not to allow the Christ or divine imagery to get in the way. I don't want to be fooled by a meager serving of Christology, by a small helping of incarnation at Christmas time. Let me suggest a way that one could reconstruct the incarnation of Jesus. Try it on before you say, no way. The way that I say incorporates aspects of Jesus' life that few people may be comfortable with. And here goes. The divine fullness of God was born a bastard as Jesus, son of Mary, a teenage mother. His foster father was of the artisan class. He was temporarily homeless at his birth and apparently permanently homeless by the time he died. He grew up Jewish, receiving a life-changing call from God at about age 30, and lived out a very quick career as an untraditional, even troublemaking rabbi. He was executed by the state with cooperation from the religious sector. So far, maybe not so shocking, but try this on. The Jesus we profess in Christ, in order to experience fully the incarnation, had and used his sexuality. Sexuality is a most important part of being human. How many of you said, when I said sexuality? How many times have we not heard the church say that sexuality is an important part of being human? Jesus, married, not married, but married, with perhaps little children of his own. There's a book by William Phipps, which our library here does not have, but it's called, Was Jesus Married? It's subtitled, The Distortions of Sexuality in Christian Tradition. And Dr. Phipps, I guess, says to the question, was Jesus married? He says probably. He doesn't say certainly. He says probably. And Phipps uses the cultural norms of the day, the assumptions of what a regular young Jewish boy would go through as he was growing up, and he said that probably around the age 19 or 20, Joseph arranged for Jesus to be married. An arrangement is an arranged marriage. Rabbis, it was just understood, got married. It was not traditional for a rabbi to be unmarried. So how does this fit today with our theme of incarnation? Have we come down too heavy on the incarnation and too light on the docetism? Maybe so. But let's try it on just to see how it fits. Jesus came as God in flesh to be one of us. How can he be one of us if he had to check his sexuality at the door and not use the sexual organs that we all are given, not express his sexuality? We all do express our sexuality, don't we? Whether we know it or not, we do. Sexuality matters. And it is an incarnational issue. I'd like to bring it in on the blackboard and say it is an incarnational issue. Is this new to you? Is this new? Have we all, am I just saying something you've all heard before?
Well, it was on the Last Temptation of Christ in the movie.
Oh.
I mean, that's, but what I'm wondering as I listen to you is my reaction to that movie, which is, you know, somewhat of what I'm reacting to now, is why is that so important? I mean, what about Jesus Christ, in my experience and in my knowledge of the resurrection and of his life and teachings mm-hmm. that are revealed to me through the scriptures, how are those teachings and how is that resurrection changed or altered by incorporating these components that you're suggesting?
If my sexuality ain't resurrected, then part of me is not resurrected. Church says, many churches say that sexuality is the chief sin and is there mainly as our fall. But if the resurrection is a reality, then our sexuality needs to be taken seriously because it too will be resurrected.
So by positing that Jesus was married, by positing that Jesus had a family, that follows then, I mean that follows that component of his life.
What is so much an important part of our life? Why do we demand a Savior that does not participate in that also? Now, I haven't seen The Last Temptation. And I didn't even think about it until you mentioned it. Mm-hmm. So, this is just, I'm not arguing in that context. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, in that particular movie, I'm not sure how many people saw it here, but what was so disturbing for me was not that Jesus might have been married or had sexual relationships, but rather that there was no resurrection in that movie. I mean, the movie ended before there was any resurrection.
Yeah.
And so, in my opinion, the focus was certainly on an exaltation mm-hmm. of the earthly existence, which then there was no hope. I mean, mm-hmm. by ending before there was any resurrection, there was no hope. There was just a lot of room for confusion and imaginations to go awry. And so, as you're talking, and I mean, I'm certainly not saying that's what you're positing, but I think that there is really a tendency, kind of a human tendency, to go more toward that direction when people start to focus on the intricacies of earthly existence.
I am in the mainstream in that I probably believe in many Orthodox ways, all the Orthodox teachings of our churches. All I'm trying to do is add some more meat, or if that's a bad word around here, but add some more protein to this doctrine, which I think is quite anemic, to go back to that bad word. So I'm just trying to, and I think the resurrection still works in the way that I presented Jesus as one who used his sexuality, because everything that we are gets resurrected. Yes?
I think as one who has read a lot of Cousin Zaka's and responded to a number of angry letters because I allowed The Last Temptation of Christ to be shown on campus. I know. I'm glad I certainly need, but I'll throw stones at it. I think one of the really important things about remembering the humanity of Christ is that there are a number of them. One of them is it makes for me his suffering much more real.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, was Jesus on the cross just playing a game? I mean, if you forget the human and don't think about the pain and the doubt and the fear, you know, did Jesus have fear? Was his stomach churning as he went to the cross? I mean, those sorts of things for me make his suffering and indeed his resurrection much more significant. And I think some of that is lost, but I think maybe is part of what Mark's trying to do here. Some of that is lost if you think of Jesus, you know, came down and put on this mask and went through all these, this sort of charade for us, but I mean, for me, it's important that Jesus really did have doubt and anguish and fear and pain and suffering, or else he didn't really fully enter into that.
Our humanity is not a joke. It's not something that God jokes around with. And I think that all the issues of sexuality are not a joke either. But they are very real, pressing issues. And these are not neglected by the incarnation. They may be neglected by the other Christians with whom we associate. But maybe we can start a conversation to bring these back. So, your mental finger again, about Greeks.
30% of English is cognate Greek.
So,
we are still bound in those patterns. I think the one that we're most bound in is the whole idea that we talk as though, and we do this in the church most recently, as though sexuality were a good thing. And we haven't, as a church doing doctrine, we haven't done that.
This is Neoplatonism, that which is also in effect as a philosophical paradigm during the time of that Council of Chalcedon. According to Neoplatonism, there are three levels of the universe. There is spirit, pneuma. There is nous, which is mind, which participates in pneuma, and soma. Soma is body, matter. This is a hierarchy. The higher you go, the better you are. The lower you go, the worse off you are. So, if you have a Christology that participates in soma, to some people who are persuaded by Greek thinking, then your Christology is going to be suspect because it doesn't participate in the more pure, esoteric, spiritual, using that in quotation marks, realities. So this is another aspect of why, of what I'm arguing, of what I'm trying to labor against. Just
seems to me it pushes to the question of how a Greek would approach materialism or the physically, mm-hmm. as over against the Hebrew. Mm-hmm. Both would be considered, in a sense, materialist or celebrated incarnation, but they celebrated very different ways, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And what struck me as you were speaking was that the Greeks would take that which is material, or physical, or sexual, much more as a plaything, mm-hmm. which we do in our own culture, mm-hmm. much more than a Hebrew. But it also struck me that since you posit that Jesus was the first homeless among us, he might also have been the first celibate among us, expressing sexuality that way for the sake of others.
Yes. That's another option that people also say.
Yeah.
But people would say, if he had the sexual organs and didn't use them, then how is that going to relate to me? That kind of thing. I've heard it said much more graphically at Union's Theological Seminary. I will not impress those upon you, but...
I think part of the context that, as you pointed out in the beginning, the contextual nature of reflection on this is that the confusion within the church of its own sense of sexuality and our confusion in contemporary confusion about sexuality, sensuality, dying, etc. And that gets, I think, mixed with any kind of reflection on if we are on a journey to recover the origin, of what that's about, then we have to face up to how contaminated that is on our own confusion. So that's a kind of a catch-22 if you want to get into contextualism, that we're we're double bound. And I think we just have to admit that in terms of how important is it to come to some, you know, what does it say about us that we have to come to some conclusion of whether or not Jesus was sexually active as being the working issue around what it means to be incarnate in the fully human. That may not be the working question.
Right.
Okay. But what do you do with in the move towards recovering the humanity of Jesus in our Christology with at least my sense is that sometimes we fall into almost a pure Pauline thing of flesh, kind of shoving John and Paul like sarks in terms of what that is. The sarks is not in the somatize.
Sorry?
Sarks is not on there, but somatize.
Yeah, maybe I should have put
sarks. I'm just wondering what we do with recovering the humanity of Jesus if we take flesh seriously, what that's about. It's the ultimate context of being within human bondage, the dilemma.
Is there a response?
Well, is there a possibility that the question we really ought to look at first is how we got the two separated? How did nous get separated from soma? How did the mind and the body get separated in our thinking so easily? So much so that we have an ordinary population that hardly knows to talk about spirit, much less how, I mean, wouldn't that lead us into a discussion then of how, in fact, that's what we all are about in order to talk about being human? And that the whole idea of hierarchy is what's a major flaw in that schema. Mm-hmm.
Where is sexuality on this schema?
Aha.
So on, right?
Yeah, it's pretty low. And I can't cite chapter and verse, but the studies have been done that shows that many Western societies have perpetuated this very schema up until our present day. And so the Victorian age was not an accident, but a full flowering of this repression of that self, of that part of ourselves.
Yeah. Have you read Phoenix for the Kingdom?
No, I haven't.
Mm, yeah.
Is that an
article? Oh, yes.
Is that, okay. Scott?
Well, I was just going to say, 12 years ago when I did a doctoral dissertation, a piece of it was on dose system, and I went around and had this, you know, theological inventory. And I was convinced at that time docetism is still well and alive in the church. It's really the one permissible heresy. You can be very docetic in your views about Jesus, and that's just fine in the church. You can't be very
very incarnation.
You know, you can't move in the other direction or you get thrown out of the church.
I have a theory as to why that's true, and that might be that sometimes churches tend to go into a triumphal view, and sometimes churches tend to go into a servant role in expressing their theology and worship. And when a church is in its more triumphant mode, it's not going to be dealing so much with issues of humanity. Whereas the servant church is going to be out on the streets with the people that are hurting in the flesh, that all the problems of society are being incarnated in, and this is this. So, when you look at the church that you're in, is the church moving towards most of the time a triumphant view of Jesus, or a more servant view of Jesus? So.
But Mark, the thing I was going to ask was I had never thought of this before, but it is interesting how quickly Jesus' sexuality or humanity was written off, because docetism was a major aspect very quickly in the life of the church, wasn't it? Right?
Yes.
I remember my.
It was, the first heresy.
And it's interesting that scheme is still
much alive today, then I suppose it's consistent that we continue to write up Jesus' humanity. And is that also why people like Augustine and others have such a hard time with sexuality?
I would imagine so. Just looking at it from a 20th century point of view as the inheritor of this three-tiered scheme. Anything else before we press on? This is a good discussion, I think. I'm in a concluding mode anyway, and it is my view that there has rarely been a sustained, holistic, and wholesome view of how Christians are to be sexual. Most of the time we've been told, just say no. Deny it. Check your sexuality at the door. Of the church, that is. The Christian church has conspired, I think, against a healthy view of sexuality. And therefore, our humanity is never presented fully in Christian settings. And Jesus' humanity ain't either. It is important that Jesus be incarnate. I mean, fully incarnate. It matters to me that Jesus was a fully responsible, and that is, response-able. Excuse me, I have to move now. It matters to me that Jesus was a fully responsible human with flesh. And he had to exercise responsible human decisions about his human life. Starting with Greeks, or maybe before, our church history is 2,000 years of examples about how not to be a responsible, response-able human. Christianity, to me, as I grew up, was largely a matter of the mind. And the spirit. These kinds of issues did not enter, were not caught up in our worship. We're not part of it. Now, I grew up Southern Baptist, and you know, we're a special case in many respects, but I don't know, but I may be representative of Protestant Christianity in the United States in the latter part of the 20th century. And you can prove me wrong. I'll be glad to be proved wrong. But I think my hunch is that I'm onto something, that I'm on the right path here. Only rarely does the Christianity that I grew up with become a matter of living correctly or loving correctly. It was always a process of thinking correctly. So this had to be correct. This didn't have to be correct. We could still beat wives or abuse children and still, and if we had this all right, it was, you know, we were still Christian. This was not caught up in and redeemed or spoken about. I think our past presents our seeking to live and love correctly. I think it prevents our ability to live and love correctly in deep modes. Whenever we start thinking about living correctly, loving correctly, we quickly get tired about thinking about these things. And I think this is an incarnational issue. So, how much incarnation can Christ withstand? How much docetism can our Christ withstand? What does our church do with Jesus' body? I think our faith is bound to a criterion of an earthy Jesus. Let me say that again. I think our faith as Christians is bound to a criterion of an earthly and earthy Jesus. And if we're going to give our lives over to this Jesus, I think it's crucial that we understand what kind of life he himself led. Today I've stretched out, I think, the implications of what an incarnation might mean in terms of Jesus.
can we afford to do Christology without a full-bodied, full-flavored view of what that means? And my answer, my tentative answer is no. And we can talk about that. Tomorrow, I will be speaking about conflicting tensions between Jewish Messiah and Christian Christ. But we now have some time for discussion. Yes.
Mark, do you think it would be helpful, you phrased the question there, how much incarnation can your Christ withstand? But do you think that that's part of the confusion? Would it be better if we made some careful distinctions between Jesus and Christ?
Yes, if I've been not careful, that would be corrected, yes.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I just, I mean, Jesus obviously is a word that refers to this historical person.
Yeah.
And Christ is a word that speaks of the whole notion of the Messiah, which is a notion that was in existence long before Jesus and long after Jesus. And I suppose for us as Christians, the question is, what is the relationship between the two? But they do represent two different entities,
yes,
right?
They do, yeah. And two different streams of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, two different realities that we say come together in this person, but nevertheless, and we as Christians kind of use those words interchangeably,
my sin too.
What?
My sin also.
Well, you have to agree with me. Yeah. I'm just throwing this out.
Well, I think it does make some sense to leave it as I did. How much incarnation can the Christ withstand, your view of Christ? Because if we start thinking of Jesus, for example, with a sexuality, that's going to blow some people's views of Christ out of the water.
When I think of the word Christ, I think of, all the different kinds of messianic expectations. Mm-hmm. I think of the ones that Jesus rejected, the ones he seemed to accept. I think of, there's all kinds of messianic expectations mm-hmm. in our world today. Which ones are related to Jesus? Which ones aren't? What does it mean for me to relate to those, that reality? Then I also think of Jesus, this man, was a sexual being and lived and died, and people experienced us alive again afterwards. It seems to me we kind of, maybe part of our problem is we get all those things all kind of jumbled up. Somehow it would be better to find ways of talking about these things, which brought some clarity.
I said at first that Christ is not Jesus' last name. I don't know if you were in at the time.
No, I wasn't. But yeah, but, I mean, that is the main narrative, right? Yeah.
Not Christ. Was there a question over here?
Well, I'm still struggling, because I think it's also what you're pushing into is what kind of incarnation can our Jesus have? Because if all we're going to do is recover the soma in the Greek, we're going to just elevate the lower portion of the construct there to its maximum possibility, which is not great in a Hebrew construct. Whereas if you take a Hebrew shalom concept and then speak of incarnation in that context, it seems to me to come out differently. It would be fascinating to me to hear what the sexual practices, a contrast of the sexual practices of the Greek and the Hebrew at the time of Jesus. And see where that leads.
Tune in tomorrow.
Are we going to get there?
I'm not speaking so much of Jesus. I'm going to speak of Jewish messianism,
yes, and, I heard that.
And how the Christian views of Christ are sort of a shadow, create a shadow on the Jewish perceptions of Messiah.
Well, And I guess my perception of the question that you're posing for us in terms of resolving it, somehow, and I'll go back with you, to the Hebrew view, we have to erase the lines between those three categories.
Exactly.
Somehow, we have to integrate what that is, or else we have to do something entirely different, because that particular tripartite division is very painful for our life and our society.
Ain't true for her.
And what we didn't mention is that it's especially painful for women, because women, some of it was worse than men, some of it, because men could participate in, were seen as participating up here much better, more easily than women.
Are you kidding? Men were identified with noose and women were identified with soma.
Right. Well, said the Apolite as well.
Well, we all have the scriptures that said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall know.
Well, our time is up, and I thank you so much for an engaging time. And we'll see you some more.
We're just getting moved.
Parking.
I did read. I have read that temptation. What else? 10 years ago.
You are also in the family.
Christians.
No, after.
Right, cousins?
Fine.